Nun way nangil wa sereer radio o ñoxur no sereer fop
du bi seduk sereer radio o sorki sereer ti jenn.
Vous écoutez sereer radio, la voix de la communauté sereer.
You are listening to sereer radio, the voice of the sereer community.
Lingolo hun kominetro yakari ae njogoina nomtido.
Welcome to Sereer Radio. You are listening to the Open Mic Show with me, Tamsia Diouf. Thank you for joining us. My guest today is Dr. Ismaila Cisse, who is the presidential candidate from the Gambia Citizens Alliance Party. And Dr. Cisse is by far one of Gambia's most prominent academic stone politicians. He has managed to stir up a lot of interest, especially among the youth, and it's a pleasure to have him on the show. But before I bring him on, I just want to give a brief background of my guest, and that is Dr. Cisse, who I've got on the line. Dr. Cisse was born in Brikama, but spent some of his teens in Sierra Leone prior to moving to Sweden. In Sweden, he acquired a bachelor's degree in political science and then moved to Scotland to pursue a master's in African studies at Edinburgh University. Throughout his academic career, he has authored numerous papers relating to Gambian and African politics. In 2010, following his return to the Gambia, he secured a job as a political science and African studies lecturer at the University of the Gambia. He has won numerous awards and recognitions over the past few years, including the Most Influential Young Person of the Year and the Pan-African Humanitarian Award for Excellence in Social Leadership and Community Impact. In 2018, he was arrested by the Gambian police for an interview he gave to the Voice newspaper, where he stated, and I'm paraphrasing here, long-term security will not be restored in the Gambia if President Adama Barrow does not win the trust of the Gambian army. He was charged with incitement of violence, but released the following day with all charges dropped. Since then, he has become President Adama Barrow's most ferocious critic. In 2020, he was successfully elected as the Citizen Alliance candidate to contest the December 2021 Gambian presidential elections. Dr. Ismaila Cisse, welcome to Sereer Radio and thank you for joining us on Open Mic.
Thank you, Tamsin, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Let's just get into it. I've got a couple of questions that I lined up for you. I'm sure Hartikoli, the listeners would be interested to know a little bit about you. And that is actually how I'm going to start. Just to get a little bit of taste of who you are as a person for the benefit of the listeners who will be voting in the December 2021 presidential election. So my first question is, in an interview that you gave to Alhaji Mane from the Standard newspaper in November 2019, you stated your ethnicity as Mandinka. Is that correct?
Yes, but I started by saying, first of all, I'm Gambian. But because Gambia is a country where socially people are compartmentalized into tribes. So therefore, I was born as a Mandinka. Yes, I'm a Mandinka.
Yes, you are Mandinka. Right. Yes, that is correct. You did Hartikoli preface it by saying that Hartikoli, you are Gambian force. So that is correct. Yes. Yeah. And both your parents Mandinka?
My father is Mandinka. My mom. Not Mandinka. My mom is Limba and Fula.
Your mom is what?
Limba and Fula.
Limba and Fula. Okay. And would you classify yourself as a devout Muslim?
Yes, a devout Muslim. A practicing Muslim.
A devout Muslim. So you would classify yourself as such?
Yes, a practicing devout, practicing Muslim.
A practicing Muslim, right. And in that case, then, to what extent does your religious views and teachings influence your decision and policy making, Dr. Cisse?
Not to a very much extent. Religion is private, and Gambia is a secular state, and we try to divorce religion from state. So my religious beliefs are not in any way influence my policy decisions, because Gambia is not an all-Muslim country. We have Muslims and Christians in that country. When we make policy for every Gambian, whether you're Muslim or Christian.
Okay, and
obviously, my religion will not influence my policy decisions.
And of course, there are others who practice traditional African religions, of course, just to include them in the picture.
Exactly.
Right, okay. Now, I do understand that you have dual nationality, which is Gambian and Swedish. And in the interview you gave to Keba Jafang from the Chronicle in November 20, he put it to you that in accordance with Gambia's constitution, you would be unable to stand as a presidential candidate due to your dual nationality. Now, in that interview, you did say that you will be lodging an application to revoke your Swedish citizenship. Have you done so, and what is the outcome?
That process has started. It's a process that doesn't, decisions are not taken like that. So the process is on, but hopefully very soon it will be revoked.
And
all Gambia,
okay.
All Gambian people.
And have you had any, how to call it, when do you expect to have to get an outcome from that? Do you know? Have you been?
I don't have an idea. What I've received is that they've received the application and they've get back.
So they have responded to your application to revoke, for revocation.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Now, Dr. Cisse, could you tell us why you have decided to stand as a presidential candidate, and why do you think you or your party, the Citizen Alliance, are fit for the job and should lead the country?
We live in a country that for 57 years have been experiencing failed promises since independence. We've had a lot of potentials in that country. However, the potentials have not been transformed into ensuring every Gambian lives a dignified life. So we realize that the potential of that country has not been aligned with the leadership that is needed to build that country. So there is that misalignment. Gambia has a wealth of resources.
So do you...
Sorry
for interjecting.
57 years after independence, we realize we've achieved very little as a country, despite the resources. And we believe that one of the reasons, or the primary reason why that is happening, is we have lacked effective, innovative leadership. And we are here to provide that leadership to ensure we harness our resources and build a country for every Gambian, those living in the Gambia now and those who are yet to come, that is the next generation.
But what experiences have you had so far that you think will have to propel you to take on this mighty task if you become president?
No president has presidential experience before they become president.
But some presidents have managed businesses.
However, we have a team of experienced people in various fields. We have Mr. Dominic Mendy, who is our national chairman, who is the party chairman, who is an excellent economist, worked in government as minister before. We have a lot of people also in our party that are experienced. However, based on my own experience, I have led organizations. I've led the political science department, after the department for 5 years. I was the president of the staff association at UGG. I was president of Gambians living in Sweden at some point for 2-3 years. So we've got experience in terms of public service. What is important for a president is public service. And once you have experience in that, once you have the passion and the drive, I think, and the right program, and the Citizens Alliance has the right platform, that I can be able to excel in together with the team to build the country we want.
Okay. Now, you had a respectable career as a professor at the University of the Gambia that was educating our youth with the brain drain that is taking place all over Africa. I mean, your return back to the Gambia was a noble gesture. Why all of a sudden have you decided to abandon your youth in order to advance your own political ambitions?
Well, I did not decide to abandon them. When I was deciding to come to Gambia in 2009, to leave everything I was doing in Europe, to come and sacrifice and work at the university to prepare the young people for the task ahead, the task of nation building, by equipping them with the right tools. That was a sacrifice, and I was doing it for 11 years. And I thought now it's time for me to go for more challenges. I want to be part of that generation that will build the Gambia for today and for tomorrow. And at some point, I realized that if the overall governance framework is not right, nothing can be right in that country. University cannot be right. Nothing can be right. So at 2016, we thought things will change. It did not. So we thought now it's time for us to get into governance to build this country so the university can be right as well.
So, but that is still abandoning, the people who have dependent, because obviously we need people like you in the education system, because the education is a very, very key, sector. Without proper education, obviously, the population is practically doomed. So we need people like you. You actually did made the noble gesture of just returning back, and then you abandoned them. So
I wouldn't use the word abandon. I went for more bigger challenges for the Gambia. If the governance system is not right, the education system cannot be right. And I realized one thing at UGG: the quality had plummeted. by over 100% compared to since I started. I knew that we need a new governance framework for the Gambia so the irrigation system can be right. If you have one of the CCGT at UTG, but UTG doesn't have the necessary equipment or the manpower and the technical power to ensure we build a Gambia, then there's no point in Dr. CCGT wasting his time at UTG.
But why why didn't you particularly your union or your association lodge a particularly send a strong letter to the Ministry of Education asking demand them to particularly think about adjusting their budget? I mean, particularly you could do that.
I can see you've done a bit of research on me, but I think you missed some point. Did you know that I led a strike at UTG on two occasions?
I am aware of how to call it, the strike that you had led, yes.
Exactly. So that was it. I led the strike, the first ever strike at UTG, asking for things to be changed, asking for the government and the UTG to invest in UTG, to invest in higher education. So obviously, say, we've been working hard, we've been struggling at UTG to ensure we build a modern university. But however, we realize that the governance system is not right. We have to make sure we build the governance structure. Build the governance system. And for me, it was right. For me, it's the time for me to go for more bigger challenges for the Gambia. I thought the Gambia needed me now in politics than I think it did.
Okay. Thank you for that. I mean, there's a lot of crackling noise at the background. I don't know what is that. I don't know whether you can just stay put in one.
It's all right. Yeah, it's all right.
Okay. Right. And in the beginning, in my introduction, I did mention your criticisms of President Adama Barrow. Now, I want to touch on that a little bit. I mean, in the past few years also, you have made quite a number of attacks and allegations against Barrow. Just to quote some of these ferocious attacks, in an interview that you did with Pandery Bayi from Freedom Newspaper in 2018, you referred to Barrow as clueless and someone who has no idea about governance. And in your interview with Keba Jiangfang from The Chronicle in November 2020, you accused Barrow of presiding over the most corrupt government the Gambia has ever seen in history, with very little regard to the plight of the population, with so much focus on his agenda to enrich himself at any cost, even putting lives at risk. Dr. Cisse, would you agree that these are rather harsh words to use in the political arena and somewhat rather expansive, especially the claim that this is the most corrupt government in Gambian history?
But facts are facts. We don't sugarcoat facts. That is the problem with Africa. When we sugarcoat facts and because we think they are harsh, we don't have to say it. We bury them under the ground. We have the Maslow syndrome. That is why we've been backward.
But Dr. Cisse,
we need to say things. But what, I mean, this is the most corrupt government that we've seen since independence. And that is the fact. There is no better way to say it. That's the
fact. Why are the facts?
The facts are very clear. We've heard about the $35,000. Money that went AWOL. We don't know where it is. We've seen about the contracts that they've been signing left, right, and center without following due process. We've seen now how public officials are building expensive buildings, driving expensive cars with nothing to account for it.
Then obviously you seem to have understated the Jammeh regime, because to call the President Barrow now, whatever anyone might think of him, to call him and his administration as the most corrupt government in Gambian history, I think that is overstating it, because particularly you seem to have understated then the Jammeh regime.
You as a journalist have your opinion, I have my opinion. You think it's an overstatement, I think it is the right word. So we can argue about this until next year, we wouldn't reach consensus.
But you haven't provided me facts, Dr. Cisse. You haven't provided me any facts.
I'm giving you the facts that, one, we have many cases about. We have a $35 million case that was money that was transferred into the First Lady's account. Still, we don't have anything there's no accountability today about that. We've seen contracts being signed left, right, and center. We've seen drugs coming into that country, drug busts happening into that country, and nothing is happening about it. And also, we've seen since the coming of this government, we have not seen anybody tried for economic crime. You cannot tell me that since Jammeh Barrow came to power, nobody has committed economic crimes in that country. We've seen the Jammeh Commission, how the white paper was selectively applied. All these are, so when we say corruption, it doesn't only mean monetary corruption. It means even in terms of administration.
Of course.
In terms of how you administer the country. So we've seen things that are happening now. Listen, I wish you read Malagan report yesterday. As a journalist, I think you should read it by Mustafa Dabo, saying that under the James era, Gambia had produced, for the whole of James period, 277 diplomatic passports for 22 years. Under Barrow, over 1,300 diplomatic passports. In fact, over 3,000 diplomatic passport books have gone missing in that country. You heard about diplomatic passport scandal in that country. You cannot tell me that is not corruption.
But what I'm saying to you is this. I mean, Hatikoli, in light of Hatikoli, the numerous atrocities during the Jammeh regime, in light of Hatikoli, the number of thefts, and Hatikoli money and drug that you are complaining about Barrow. I mean, Hatikoli, it was more I would have thought in Hatikoli during the Jammeh regime. So I'm not actually making any judgment at all about Hatikoli, that view that you seem to hold so dear regarding Hatikoli and Barrow, but I'm just contrasting here between the Barrow administration and the Jammeh administration. And from what you are telling me, you seem to have understated the Jammeh regime and what was going on then.
I'm not understating anybody's performance. What I'm saying is that under Jammeh, at least people were charged for financial crimes. Under Barrow, we've seen how he was able to amass the amount of wealth Barrow is able to amass, as we've seen the things and his political party, NPP. Jammeh did not amass it in his 4 years in power. Jammeh did not build a mansion in Mankamankunda in 4 years.
But Jammeh was a businessman, though, Dr. Sise.
He was a what?
Wasn't he a businessman before he came into power?
Who?
Excuse me, Barrow.
He's a businessman before he came to power.
Wasn't he a land?
Being a businessman doesn't mean that you are a millionaire in the Gambia. We all live in the Gambia. Yeah, that's why when they told them to publish their assets, they did not. They say it was not going to be public. We wish it was public so we know what they came with. In fact, that is where it started. The lack of accountability. That publish your assets at the ombudsman, and they said, okay, we'll submit it, but we'll declare our assets, but no, it's not to be published to the public.
But what kind of business was Barrow in before he came into Hatikoli and politics?
You're asking me that?
Yes.
I think you know it, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That's, I'm asking you, what do you think it was? What was it?
Well, according to what we read, he's an estate agent. He was running an estate agent.
Well, and properties as well. So property is a high-value asset. Wouldn't you agree?
What I'm saying, can you name me one property that Desi Barrow has developed as a property developer? At least TAF, if you tell me TAF, it's developed properties. We've seen it. If you go to Global Properties, they've developed properties. You've seen it. Name me one property that they said Barrow's company developed this property. Name me one.
No, but what you are doing, Hatikoli, you are comparing Hatikoli apple with oranges. Obviously, Hatikoli, like yes, Puff is a multi millionaire, and Hatikoli, even if you want to have a go at President Barrow, you might call him a low scale property developer, but he was still a property developer and he still owned
but
assets.
But name me one property he's developed. Show me one that is developed.
I'm the one asking the questions, Dr. Ismail Assisi.
No. You don't know. If you ask questions, you have to ask the right questions. Name, if you call him a property developer, I didn't call him a property developer. I call him an estate agent. You call him, I say, name one property developer. If you are a property developer.
Well, I own lots. For example, I own a couple of properties, Hatikoli, like, and I do rent them, but I'm not going to be listing them, calling them Hatikoli, this development.
Then you are not a property developer, you are a rent collector.
I mean, what?
You are a rent collector, not a property developer. If I give you my property to rent out and receive my rent, you collect rent on my behalf. What is it? Someone who develops property, invest and builds properties and sell them or rent them. If you just take my property and you rent, you collect rent on my behalf, you are a rent collector.
You didn't hear the response that I gave you. I said I own them and had to rent it out. Well, and some of them I've built myself. And some of them I've built myself.
Own them, yeah, if you own them, it's a different thing.
Yeah, that's what I said.
But then you cannot name me one property in the Gambia that Barrow was that he owned.
But anyway, Hatikoli, but the point of the matter is, Hatikoli, not everyone is going to have a name of Hatikoli, like estate, like Paradise Estate. Some of them haven't reached that level yet.
Nobody talked about estates. Yeah. I never used the word, in fact, estate. I said, they've developed properties, we've seen it. Because they're property developers.
Yeah,
they invest massively. They invest, they build properties, they either sell or rent them. Now, if you cannot do that, you're not a property developer.
Well, Hatikoli, we will leave that to the listeners to decide. Now, Do you still stand by these allegations? I just want to clarify. I mean, it seems to, I believe you have, but I'm just wanting from the horse's mouth. Do you still stand by these allegations, despite knowing that from, or at least, President Barrow has never officiated either overtly or covertly, as far as I'm aware, massive executions or secret executions, raping, kidnapping, and all that stuff. You still stand by these allegations? The calling him the Hatikwel, the most corrupt government, the most corrupt government.
You as a journalist should know that a corrupt government doesn't equate to a government that violates human rights.
But in here, but in this regard, you also went on to talk about Hatikwel, how he is putting lives at risk.
What that means is that when you put lives at risk, it means that you don't give them the basics in life. You don't give them quality healthcare. If people don't have quality healthcare, you cannot go to a hospital and get cured. Then your life is at risk. If you cannot get access to good education to survive, your life is at risk. So these things are open to interpretation. If we say corruption put lives at risk, it doesn't mean that they go and kill people. No, it means that money can be invested in education, in healthcare. To buy medicine, train staff, buy equipment, is diverted to people's pockets. You are putting lives at risk because if you get sick, you go to the hospital. If there is no medicine, you are sick. If there is no doctor, your life is at risk. If you have an accident along the Kiang Road, there is no emergency response to save your life is at risk. If we don't invest in food and people go home, go to bed hungry, the children, their lives are at risk. If children cannot get access to proper education, they grow up in a country where they have no opportunities and they take the pathway to go to Europe, their lives are at risk. That is the context that you have to understand.
I understand the context that you are trying to make, but I want to Hatikwel, for me, it is quite Hatikwel, it seems quite rather expansive to jump Hatikwel the Jammeh era and then label President Adama Barrow's government as Hatikwel the most corrupt and so forth and so forth.
Because it is the most corrupt ever. There is no strategy to fight corruption. There is no goodwill. There is nothing. They don't even talk about corruption. They don't even talk. I've never heard the government talk about corruption. Never. They don't even talk about it.
And have you heard it from President?
The Anti-Corruption Commission is still dead. It's not out yet. They are supposed to establish one. It's not established. So obviously, that is my opinion. You can disagree with it. You can agree, but that is my opinion, and you cannot change it.
Okay, that's fair enough. But do you think, Hatikwel, it is a presidential thing to say, to call the leader of this Hatikwel country a clueless? And I can understand you can offer criticism. That is no problem. You can offer criticism. I'm not Hatikwel. No, that is your prerogative. And Hatikwel, but to make some such personal attacks, like Hatikwel him clueless and all the stuff. Do you think Hatikwel is overstretching it?
Why are you personalizing the clueless thing? I mean, if I call you clueless as a journalist, it means that you have no idea how to be a journalist. That was the context. See, context is key.
Yeah, context
and
is key.
It's always when politicians speak, you have to understand those things. When I was speaking, when I was saying clueless, that was immediately after the transition. And that was interview was about my assessment of the transition. And I said that the guys running the government in Banjul are clueless. They don't know what they are doing. And I still stand by it.
Okay, I want to talk about your arrest on 31st of January 2018. And you were arrested by the Gambian police in relation to the interview you gave to the Voice newspaper, where you said, and I'm quoting here, the presence of economic sub-regional forces in the Gambia will not prevent long-term security risk, and that long-term security will not be restored if the president does not win the trust of the army. Although I do not believe that there was any basis for the arrest, can you see how this statement, taken at face value, and the fragile state of Gambian security at the time, how that could have aroused suspicion that you might be calling for a coup d'etat or inciting violence against a democratically elected president, which led to your arrest and pending investigation?
My statement was twisted and politicized. You see, that statement led to my arrest, but it is not the only statement that led to my arrest. The government in Banjul saw me as the sole person who was critiquing that government, holding them to account at a time when people were mute and thinking that nobody should criticize this government. I was the only one criticizing. I was the only one speaking out, holding them to account, and they were not happy with that. So that interview with the Voice was used as a pretext to try to silence me, but they failed woefully.
Who was trying to silence you?
the government in Banjul, obviously, but on his team. Because
how do you know this?
Someone who was, they are the ones who arrested, isn't it?
Well, that is what you told the reporters, but particularly, were there any witnesses to that, other than the police?
The police told me that they got orders from above. Where is above?
Who told you this?
The police who arrested me said they got orders from above. In fact, they were supposed to bail me, but they said no, orders from above say you should spend the night here, you cannot be bailed. So where is above?
Well, it could be hard to call it from the superintendent, the chief of police. It could be anybody, but you don't know whether it came from.
But the government sends this. Somebody came from State House to interrogate me for 4 hours.
How do you know the person was from State House?
He introduced himself as a special agent from State House.
He introduced
after the Interpol, after the guys in Banjul headquarters are ready. A special agent was sent from State House to interrogate me, and he introduced himself as coming from State House.
Do you know the name?
From State House to interrogate me.
What is his name?
No, I'm not going to give you his name.
But obviously, if somebody from State House coming to threaten you and trying to call you,
he did not threaten me. I did not say threaten.
Okay,
him.
To interrogate you.
Me for 4 hours. And in front of the police officers, he introduced himself as an agent from the State House. He was sent to come and interrogate me in line with the case.
But I'm quite, Dr. Cissé, I mean, you have been quite vocal and direct about your criticism of Jammeh on exactly what you want to say. Nobody has stopped been preventing you from saying what you want to say. You've been saying it. So all of a sudden, I'm quite intrigued that why you are silent on who actually this interrogator was.
What I'm saying is that it's not important who it was. What was important is that there is an agent, an officer, an institution. An officer was sent from State House to come to Banjul headquarters to interrogate me for 4 hours in line with the case. Who that person is, I'm not going to disclose his name to you because it is not important.
But we cannot verify the Hatukoli that person indeed come to Hatukoli. So indeed somebody came to interrogate you from Hatukoli State House. We can't verify that.
But you know the police officers who arrested me are still alive and they listen to the interview. You know I wouldn't lie if I know that they are listening. I have no reason to lie. So if the police officers who arrested me think that is not true, let them come out to say, no, Dr. Cissé is lying. Nobody interrogated him.
Okay.
What I'm telling you is that I have no reason to lie about this thing. I have no reason whatsoever because there are proofs that an officer came from State House as an agent to interrogate me for 4 hours. And that's a fact.
Okay, thank you. Now, on 2nd July 2020, you went to Kanifing Police Station in support of Madi Jobate, who was, of course, charged with false information and broadcasting, albeit wrongly. On that day, you did give a press conference outside the police station where you said, and I'm quoting Mamadou Diaw's article from the Punch newspaper, "The current government wants to silence critics. The current status quo is a clear indication to that. Hence why we are here today, to show solidarity and to send strong signal to the Barua government that gone are the days where you will use state security as instrument to silence critics." Do you still stand by the statement, Dr. Cissé?
Of course. My neighbor spoke outside the American embassy condemning police brutality. He got arrested and charged. We thought that was wrong. We're in a new dispensation in Gambia where freedom of speech is sacrosanct. People have the right to express their views. So why was he arrested? So we thought that we cannot accept that status quo to continue. People are there to speak their mind about national issues. So I still stand by the statement.
How do you know the arrest came from the top? From President Barrow's administration?
Which arrest?
Well, because that's what you are saying here, that President Adam Barrow must have had a hand in this arrest, including yours.
What I'm saying is that when the police officers arrest you, I was at the police station. I spoke with the SO at the station, and these orders are from above. And that's what they tell you. They are from above. And let me tell you something also. When things happen in that country, especially with security-related issues, you blame the government. It's responsible for the right of every citizen to be respected. If your right is violated as a Gambian, the government is responsible. They take full responsibility, especially in such bogus, fraudulent charges, like people speaking their mind and you charge them for inciting violence.
Okay, so but if Barrow is trying to silence his critics, as you say, then obviously he has failed miserably because you have been one of his strongest and most vocal critics, yet you are still here.
That's what I'm saying. why I said they will fail if they don't succeed. And recently we've seen how he is attacking the media, seeing how the media is biased and that the media does false reporting. Veil attack on the media. That's how it starts. That's how dictators start. They start to veilly attack the media, just like Trump was doing in the US, you know, putting the media as biased and reporting false news. A president doesn't do that. He don't attack the media publicly.
But you are still here.
Yes, I'm still here because okay. Why Gambians wouldn't allow anybody to violate Gambian rights anymore. That is why when I was arrested.
And you still have freedom to criticize him as well.
Hundreds of students came to the police station to protest for my release because Gambians will not allow a situation anymore, a system anymore that will flagrantly.
The police decided to drop the charges because article. We do not know this. I'm just going by what the police said. They decided to drop the charges, obviously, because there was nothing, no substance to the article, the allegations anyway.
That's not true.
But obviously, there were particular demonstrators that came to your defense. Yes, that is correct. But we do not know whether that was the trigger for the dropping of the charges and releasing.
I can tell you that was the trigger because I was invited into the IG's office 6 a.m. And they told me that because of the fear of mass demonstration, which could be a security threat, they are begging me to go home and that they'll drop all charges because of that.
Do you think...
The police came out to write later on, which is contrary to that, was a surprise.
Don't you think that despite the fact that you are still here and you still have the liberty to criticize Babaro as you please, what do you think might have been your plight if this was the Jammeh regime?
That is not important. It's not relevant what might have been my plight. We all fought in 2016 to remove a system, to replace with a better system where Gambians can exercise their freedom, their basic rights. So comparing what might have happened is irrelevant in this context. What we are saying is that in 2016, we voted for democracy and the rule of law, and that rights must be respected, and that is what we expect for the government to do.
No, because I'm going by Hatikoli, your statement that you made, Hatikoli, where you talk about Hatikoli, like President Barrett trying to use instrument to silence his critics, for example, you. But you are still here and you are still making criticisms against the Barrow. What I'm trying to compare is, if this was the Jammeh regime, would you have been able to speak so openly and so publicly and criticize his article, his regime?
Again, your comparison is irrelevant. It's not important.
What is important is we fought
against dictatorship. We fought against a system to replace with a new system. And I think in that new system, what we expect should happen. And that is what is happening, that people have the right to express their views.
Now, you obviously, Hatikoli, you blamed the Jammeh Barrow for Hatikoli, your arrest, Hatikoli, like, you know, and also the Madi Yobate thing, arrest as well. But it was the police who arrested you. And that is their job to have to, if they suspect there is a crime or there is potentially a crime, to arrest and have to call it, and to charge and then pending investigation. That is their job. So why are you laying the blame? I just don't understand why you are laying the blame on Barrow when that is actually just the police job just doing how to call it, the routine work, really.
Yeah, because the police have to violate their routine job. They told me that this we should be able to bail you, but orders are from above that you should spend the night here. So I go by those statements by the police that they are acting on orders from above.
Okay, now if in when they arrested you, you act and they, and as you just said just a few minutes ago, that they let you decided to let you go, but obviously you stayed and had to call it, you want. I believe actually you tried to demand an apology, an explanation, and so forth, and obviously you know, refused to go, so to speak. Why didn't you just go when they had to call, when they release you, and then if you want to take bring a case against the police, do so through your lawyer?
I did not tell them that I want an apology first before I left. I said I have to wait for my lawyer, so I know the implications of me leaving this station at this police. You cannot call me to a police station, violate my rights, my fundamental rights, and you tell me to go home. It's not going to be that easy.
Didn't you demand an apology, Dr. Cisse?
That was later on when my
lawyer... A public apology?
Yeah, that was later on when my lawyer came, after I left.
So you did?
The thing is that the time they wanted me to go, at 1 a.m., I wasn't going to go home. My lawyer had to be there to tell me what are the implications of me leaving that station. That was the was the issue. That is why I said I'm not going until Malaya comes tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. If he comes and tells me it's okay for you to go home, I'll go home. Otherwise, I'm not going anywhere.
Now, in that same conference article, the Madi Jabate thing, you went on to question the integrity of the TRRC, where you said, and I'm quoting here, "We have seen people considered to have committed heinous crimes in this country, and some people who bore the greater responsibility are put back into the system. This alone has undermined the integrity of the Truth Commission." Could you please clarify for us, Dr. Cisse, exactly what you mean by the statement? And
it has the potential to, you see, the purpose of the TRRC is to find the truth, to make sure we have justice, and to make sure people, the victims, are compensated, but also those who bore the greatest responsibility are prosecuted and they are punished. Now, we are not saying that the people, the TRRC is doing a job, a fantastic job. But if the government is undermining the TRRC, we're going to have a problem.
How are they undermining them?
Inserting people back.
How are they undermining the TRRC?
By inserting people back into government, people who there are suspicions that they bore a great responsibility in violating human rights violations in that country.
Who are these individuals that you are articulating?
Well, again, I'm not going into personal names, but we all know.
No, I don't know. I want you to tell us. My listeners do not know. Tell us, please, because you made the statement. I'm just going by what you made.
Again, I will not go into names. I don't go into personal names. What I'm saying is that we've seen people who are suspected of bearing great responsibilities being recycled.
That is not evidence, though, Dr. Cisse. As a scientist, with all due respect, you are a respected scholar, and you deal with facts and evidence. Now, you are making this very, very hypothetically, very, very bold statement here. I'm questioning you about who are these individuals and hypothetically that you refuse to name. But you.
I'm also telling you that there is ample empirical evidence to suggest what I'm saying, but I will not give you names.
So where is the evidence? Where can I find this evidence?
Well, you go and read the newspapers. You are a journalist. You know what's happening in that country.
No, but hypothetically, you are the journalists are not making it.
You as a journalist, you should do more research than me. You know what is happening.
But you, I'm not.
What I'm telling you, Tamsir, I'm not gonna give you any names. What I can tell you for sure and with certainty, we've seen people who have been to the TRRC, who have been suspected of committing crimes, they are put back into the system. Now, if you want their names, go and find out. But I'm not gonna give you those names, unfortunately.
So, would you have the evidence? Have you?
Of course, yes. It's okay. Evidence out there. It's not like it's a secret evidence.
Well, because there are lots of rumors. There are lots of article allegations going forward. But I'm evidence based person. I prefer to see the evidence. I can take your word for it, but otherwise that is not good enough, and especially for my listeners. But since you have refused to give names here on the station, if for instance. As you said, you have the evidence. If, for instance, the TRRC call you for to give evidence as a witness, would you be willing to?
People who are suspected, and they are put back into the system.
Yeah. Or any evidence that you have, that you may have.
I'll give, of course, yes. If they call me, I say that's by law, that's legal. I'll go and tell them who those people are.
Right. So you will be able. We will be willing to disclose it to the public. Yeah.
Of course, yes.
Okay. Now, after your personal attacks or criticisms of President Barrow on Pandere's Freedom newspaper in 2018, you referred to him as clueless. Is everything okay over there?
Can you repeat that, please?
Yeah. Now, I'm actually in the one of the personal attacks on the article President Barrow, and he did issue a response in a press conference at State House where he said, and I'm quoting here, "I do not want to talk about personalities. But Dr. Isimele Cisse has been a critic. Dr. Cisse has been a critic. But I asked this question and I'm still waiting for an answer. There was a president here for 22 years. The system was so bad that a lot of people had to leave this country to live in exile. And a lot of people lost their lives and a lot more jailed. People were afraid to come out and challenge the system. When Usainu Dabo was jailed, we opened an application to advertise for the leadership position for highly educated people to apply and compete against Yahya Jammeh. You know how many applications we received? Only 3. Where were these people? Where were you, Dr. Cisse, and why didn't you apply for the position?
Everything. Because I'm not a UDP member, and I'm not interested to be a UDP member at that time.
You were not a UDP, but particularly you were interested in politics, weren't you?
I was at university teaching. I was not in politics at that time, and I wasn't interested.
Okay, but you had, according to the interview that you give with Keba Jebang, you had long had an ambition interest in politics and political ambitions. So this thing did not start from within the Barrow administration. It's been there for a long time, hasn't it?
At that particular instant, I was not interested in that position. People cannot be forced to apply for positions that they are not interested in.
Okay, that's fair enough. But where were you then? Why didn't you come out in the article with all the your political interest in politics? Why didn't you come up publicly to criticize the regime and speak up against it?
Of course, I was speaking up against the regime at the university for an active student. I was the only one who was organizing symposia, seminars at the university.
But do you see Dr. Ismaila Cisse holding seminars in small rooms under the confined and comfort of a university and speaking up publicly to the people who need it most, especially in the country's darkest hour? Those are two different things, aren't they?
Well, what is your position in this case? What is your question?
My question is, you didn't come out publicly. And you had political interests, long had political interests, but you didn't come out and you didn't have to call it speak up against the regime. You enjoyed, had to call it the benefit of had to call it, because you were enjoyed, which is natural. Obviously, had to call it you. It was not just you, lots of people, in fact, they took the had to call it. It was more comfortable to keep quiet than to come out.
What is your question? That's not that. You are making a statement. Can you ask a question?
Where were you?
I was at university teaching.
So you didn't actually, you didn't contribute towards the so-called struggle, as they say.
So teaching at university is useless as not contributing, shaping young minds to prepare them for nation building. Why do you have to devalue that effort?
But in your case, it's pretty different. It's quite different because, particularly, you had long had political ambitions, and as evident now, and that's why you went to university to study it. And particularly, you had long been into, and when you came back to the Gambia, which was a noble gesture, by the way, and I would always congratulate you on that because not many people are actually returning back. And particularly, you went into the university and had to educate young minds, but you already confirmed that in your interview that you did with Keba Jebang. Now, particularly, that was during Yahya Jammeh's administration. Yet you kept silent. You didn't use your voice. You didn't use your high position within the education sector to come out and speak up publicly.
Timing was key. I was waiting for the right time. I did it at the right time. I didn't think it was the right time at that time.
Right. Now, I did see, Hatukori, from your Facebook and Twitter pages, you seem to have extended a hand to President, Usaidu Dabo from the UDP, and Fafabakari Tambong Jata from the APRC, and to Mama Kandi from the GDC for the purposes of collaboration and peaceful coexistence. Now, have you extended the same courtesy to President Adama Barrow from the NPP?
Yes, we wrote to every political actor in that country, the president included, all political parties. It is not to collaborate. We never wrote collaborate anywhere. Let me rectify that. We said to reach out, to set the stage for peaceful elections, to promote peaceful coexistence among political parties. So we wrote to every party leader, including the president.
In your article, Facebook page, I think it was on the Mama Kande's post, you did put collaboration and peaceful coexistence.
Well, collaboration in terms of promoting for reforms, obviously, parties have to work together to ensure that the legal framework is right. In that context, yes, collaboration to promote.
So you did collaborate. You did go to collaboration. Yeah, collaboration and coexistence.
If it's there, yes, it means. And what word follows after that? That's what I just read to you.
That's
important.
That's what I just read to you. Collaboration.
After collaboration. What did it write?
That's what I just read to you. Collaboration and peaceful coexistence.
And what after that?
I didn't go into that, but particularly that is the generic.
That is why I said, don't just speak a word and leave the context.
Yeah, but you said there was no collaboration though. When there was, so
if it is, we've written a lot of things. We brought statement on Mama Kande, on Ladabo, on Mama Kande Mungjata. Obviously, I can't remember all these things. One thing is that if collaboration is there, read the red whole.
It was
understand the context.
Okay, it was nothing hard to call it. I've read the context. It's nothing hard to call it collaboration, as you probably might article it. You go into article partnership or something like any sort.
Okay, as long as that is clear, that's fine.
Yeah. So anyway, article. But have you received a response from President Barrow following your invitation?
We are still waiting.
Do you expect to receive an invitation from him, an acceptance from him?
I cannot speak for him.
Following article your attacks.
I cannot speak for him.
Right. Thank you. What I want to do now, I want to delve deeper into your manifesto and to dissect some of the premises that you have made in your 2021 manifesto. Now, it is a 68-page PDF document. Unfortunately, time prevents me from discussing all aspects of it, of course. But the listeners can visit the Citizen Alliance website at www.citizenalliance.gm to read the full document. However, there are some premises that I would like to discuss with you, if I may. Now, there are four pillars in your manifesto, namely pillar one, creating economic security, economic prosperity and decent jobs. Pillar two, empowering the Gambian citizenry. Pillar three, promoting good governance and transparency. And pillar four, ensuring peace, security and stability. Let's take pillar one for instance. Now, for example, in your manifesto, you did state that the Citizen Alliance will institute measures to reduce ultimately eliminate foreign aid dependency. You then went on to tell us that your party will harness local resources to revitalize the Gambian economy and investments in agriculture, the environment, transportation, infrastructure, the arts, and the tourism. And that you will be creating 75,000 decent jobs across multiple sectors. What are these local resources that you are referring to, Dr. Cisse? And where is the money going to come from?
Local resources. You have resources to make money. Resources are not to be watched, and you exploit the resources to make money. That is why Africa has the passport. The only resources you have from Congo to South Africa.
What resources does Gambia have?
Our marine resources are one.
Marine resources. Isn't the marine resources being taken by the Chinese? And now it's quite common to hear Gambians complain about lack of fish. For example, Jen Amut.
That is why we take it from them and build the world using our marine resources. That is why we are poor, because we give out our resources to foreigners to exploit. So we take it back and take ownership of our resources, our marine resources, our agro-industrial resources, our sand resources, our tourism industry, our human resources. We have a lot of resources in that country to tap and build on, to come up with the right systems and institutions to create the world needed to invest in people.
And what actions are you going to take against the Chinese for their brutal abuse of our oceans, rivers and seas?
Well, we have to revisit the contract. Every contract has to follow due process, and anybody who is going to be dealing with us has to follow and respect our environmental laws and our labor laws. First and foremost, we take ownership of our resources. We make sure that our resources are harnessed by Gambia. Our marine sector is owned and controlled and run by Gambia, and they make profit from it and they build wealth from it. That is going to be our approach.
I'm still trying to figure out where is this all this money gonna come from to create this infrastructure, this great investment infrastructure that you're talking about, and this creation of 75,000 decent jobs. I'm still trying to figure it out, because actually you give me an example of our marine resources, but I've just told you there is no fish.
who told you there is no fish?
Well, actually the Gambians say that they had to feed Jen Amut.
No. I mean, Sujin Amuti Marte, that he made us some fish in this.
I mean, but what time
is it? It is one of the most fertile seabeds in the West African summit.
Well, it may probably it back in the day, it might have, but how to call it nowadays, it's questionable, isn't it?
No, you don't have this issue, is point. Not handling Jin Marte, it doesn't mean that Jin Amuti Gage. I mean, Jin Amuti Gage, you think I'm not going to you.
But
Jin Amuti Gage, Jin Amuti Marte.
But
there is enough gin in our ocean.
But actually, the Chinese have taken this. Dr. Cisse, I tend to deal with people that work in the ports and work in the industry itself. And I shall be asking you questions about that later. So, It is a big problem. When if you come into power, you especially our marine, which is a very huge problem. The Chinese are actually abusing it as you go grossly.
Well, that is why we'll stop. We'll take ownership. That is why we say we're going to create 75,000 jobs from that. If Gambians are given the chance and given the equipment and training to run our money industry, we create jobs through that. We cannot be allowing our country people, the Chinese, coming to exploit our fisheries resources for their own good, and we benefit nothing from it. We will stop that.
Are you going to be raising taxes if you come into power?
We'll do a tax reform. Whether it will be raised or reduced, we need to know when we get to power and see the whole entire tax regime. But then I cannot tell you for sure now that we are going to raise taxes. What we'll do is we'll do some tax reforms and see the big companies have to pay their fair share. We need to know exactly who is paying what. Are the big 10 companies paying their fair share of tax or not? We need to disclose and know exactly how much each of these big companies are paying. Sometimes the market woman is paying more tax than most of these big companies, because the market woman, once she puts her vegetable on the floor, area council comes and says, pay duty, even though she has not sold anything yet. But these big companies, we give them until the end, we give them tax exempts, we give exemptions to companies that are not supposed to get it. So we have to promote Gambia, especially small, medium enterprises that are run by young Gambians.
So what fiscal...
To tell you whether we are going to increase tax or not, we are not sure about that. What we are going to do is to...
But you should have an idea, how to call it, at least don't have some fiscal research and find out how to call it, whether it will warrant, if you come into power, you will have to increase tax or reduce tax or get some money, get the investment somewhere else. And how to call it, you haven't done that, have you?
What I'm going to tell you is that we are going to do tax reforms. Whether we'll increase tax or not, depending on which sector and who is to target. But we cannot do wholesale tax increase. We cannot do that because it's going to affect some people badly, especially small, medium businesses. That is why I say we cannot give you a straightforward answer. That's why we're going to reduce tax or increase tax. But we'll do tax reforms and adjust tax accordingly. And people have to pay what they earn. Big businesses have to pay their fair share.
Right. Now, in your manifesto, you also talk about promoting wealth creation. Are you going to be giving out grants and subsidies and so on, loans to help out small businesses? What are you going to do about it?
Yes, we'll ensure that there is access to finances. Most of our small businesses struggle because they lack access to finances.
Where is the finance going to come from?
That's why I said, once you build the industrial base to make money, to create the wealth needed, you have to do it. You get also partners, international partners want to come and invest in that country. You create the opportunity for foreign direct investment. So there are huge opportunities in that sector, in that aspect.
And your manifesto also talks about establishing a diaspora remittance fund or bond. What do you mean by that?
Well, a fund where diaspora can tap into, where diaspora can, just like foreign direct investment. The diaspora come to invest their money into the Gambia. That is the fund we are talking about, where they can get access to invest their money. They get returns, obviously, but that money is used to invest in infrastructure, so they get good returns, just like foreign direct investment. But this one, instead of foreigners outside, Gambians who are living in the diaspora will be inside.
So this one, how to call it, like, wouldn't it be somewhat what we currently have? Because it seems to, it's not that much different from what is currently going on, where Gambian diaspora, the Gambian diaspora, they just send money back home for remittance and the family. But actually, in this case, the government will have a share in it. And
when you send remittances, you send to feed your family. You don't send it for them to be invested. This one is our investment.
But
so these are two different
things. But shouldn't also the Gambian, how to call it, why would you be encouraging? Shouldn't be your government or the new Gambia at least be encouraging the diaspora, the Gambian living in diaspora to come back and live and how to call it, build the nation, rather than still living abroad in other people's countries and how to call it, like sending you money or investing, so to, as you say.
Well, if you read the entire manifesto on diaspora, we have both approaches where we encourage Gambians to come back home, those with the technical capacity, with the knowledge to come and invest their knowledge in education, health, infrastructure that is there. But also those who doesn't want to come home, also they have the chance to invest their money and they get the return for their investment. So we have a dual approach.
Now, in your manifesto, you also talk a lot about creating public-private partnerships, e.g. the creation of insurance schemes to promote livestock and crop, and also marines and marines and fisheries, electricity, road system, etc. Dr. Sisi, are you planning to privatize our entire public service?
privatize. You cannot privatize the public service. You cannot privatize certain strategic sectors like the health sector, education. You cannot do that, obviously. But again, when it comes to certain sectors, you need investment. You need the capital. And government cannot be, sometimes doesn't have the capital. You need private investors to come and you partner with government to make it happen.
But are you aware that...
Let's say, for example, you want to build, you want to engage in a massive infrastructural development to build bridges, to build roads. You don't have the money. You have investors who want to come and you go, you partner with them. These are the public-private partnership. When it comes to the public, you cannot privatize the public sector. The public sector is to serve the public service.
Yeah, but you are practically prioritizing how to go thinking of privatizing a very core sectors, how to call it, in our resources, and how to call it, the sector, for example, electricity generation, the road system, the marines, and I'm sure you appreciate the danger of
you live in the UK. Is the UK government still supplying people electricity?
Absolutely not.
There are certain sectors that will have to be privatized.
But that is what I'm coming to, Dr. Cisse. I'm sure you appreciate the controversies surrounding public-private partnership over the years, where actually the public investment, the return on public investment actually is less than the private funder, and that is why it is so controversial.
Differentiate these two. The public service, and also we have what they call the public enterprises, the NAVEX, civil aviation, GRA, ports, social security. These are state enterprises. However, our approach there is different.
Yeah, but you are actually giving partnership.
All these, what?
You are working in partnership with private, businesses to build certain infrastructure. For example, our road system, our electricity system, and the marines and so forth. That's what your manifesto says. I'm reading it from your manifesto.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not disputing. That is our approach. If we want to engage in massive infrastructural development and we don't have all the money to do it, we work with private partners
But that is what the danger of that, of course, is what is happening in Senegal, where actually the Senegalese road system, the PAS, I think they call it the PAS, actually was built by the French. Now, what happened was the French actually get 70%, almost 70% of the revenue, and they will continue to get 70% of the revenue for the next 25-30 years.
And then it becomes the owner of the Senegalese.
That's correct. Yes. So at the end of the day, the French stand to gain more than what the Senegalese are earning, and it will take them years before they even.
No way. That is debatable. If the French build it out of their total expenses, and they get their profit back, and it leaves with the Senegalese, in the meantime, they cut traffic congestion in the city of Dakar. Drive people have more time. It improves business. It improves growth. These have effects as well.
But even
in the most developed countries, UK, even in EU, these are the things that they do. Governments don't.
Well, it is everything has been privatized in the UK, and they are suffering from it, and they are complaining a lot because everything is more expensive, and sometimes actually, and you know, the service is not even good. So obviously, what
is your opinion? But this is still debatable. There are different schools of thought. There are different paradigms, economic paradigms, in terms of how to approach development.
But all the scientific paper, Dr. Cisse, all the scientific paper on how to call it, public-private partnership has been negative, and how to call it FDA, and even the how to call it, and the
I,
world.
I totally disagree with you on that. Can you name me one which is negative?
Well, how to call it?
All. No.
Well, Senegal, for instance, I've just given you one example, the Senegal public system, and also the how to call it when Lloyds Bank was about to collapse there, and they had to call it, we have to bail it out, and at the end of the day, we actually had to call it, end up we didn't get our money back, and the bank came back asking for more money. So obviously, particularly, like you know, it there are very very few. Even the particularly the World Bank is skeptical about it.
It is debatable. Anyway, I can tell you. But what I'm telling you is that any government that is serious, you need private partners to work and make things happen. That is, you cannot dispute that. Governments cannot do it. You need private partners. How you do it and how you engage and do the contractual agreement is where the problem is. I'm not the engagement itself. Nothing is wrong with going into private partnerships to make things happen.
And Hatikuri, on regards to...
We have 2 minutes, sir.
Yes, I know. I know for that, Hatikuri. Dr. Sisi, if you were to become president today, what changes would you make in your fourth year in office?
To build institutions. You see, if you don't have strong institutions at the country, so that you cannot build well, you cannot provide services to the people. We need to build, we need to reform and build strong institutions. So our focus is building strong institutions to ensure that there's accountability, there's transparency, because these things will help us fight corruption. Helping fight corruption means that we save more money and now you can invest in critical sectors. So for us, it's focusing on institutional reforms and building strong institutions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cisse. Thank you very much for speaking to Sierra Radio. And
thank you, Tom, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye. Thank you very much.
Nun way nan gilwa Sierra Radio o nyohor no Sierra fop.
Du biseduk Sierra Radio o sorki Sierra ti jen.
Vous écoutez Sierra Radio, la voix de la communauté Sierra.
You are listening to Sierra Radio, the voice of the Sierra community.
Ngolo hunko minne to yakari ae njogoi nanomtida.